Hello, and thank you for joining us on this episode of The Dev Team. I'm Mark Onsman.
I'm Daryl Kilzer.
And I'm Jake Overall.
We're a group of developers and bootcamp instructors here to help you in joining the world as a software developer. Whether you're a self-taught developer, bootcamp grad, or a CS student, we're here to help you fill in some of the knowledge you need to grow in your role as a junior developer.
In this episode of The Dev Team, Daryl will start us off giving us a little bit of a taste of cookies. I will dive into the GitHub game off, and Jake will reflect on how we teach developers.
The word of the week this week is cookies, okay? I love chocolate chip cookies.
I'm a big peanut butter fan.
Oh, the peanut butter.
Snickerdoodle is kind of where I'm at.
Yeah. Snickerdoodle. Man, I just like cookies. I like all the cookies.
I'm just going to share my cookies.
So you don't want to do that. Not these cookies. These cookies are browser cookies, essentially, right? And so a lot of people don't really know what those actually do. Most people are aware they store some information about you, potentially some sensitive information, and they share them with the website that originally issued those cookies. But another thing that they can kind of do as well is they can actually record pretty much any of your activity within your browser. So what button you click, how many times you clicked it, where out on the page you're clicking, those kinds of things. Not only that, but there's a couple different kinds of cookies. There's the ones that are issued directly from the website that you're looking at, and there's also some that can be issued from any ads on the page. So there's kind of a lot of things going on with cookies.
So let me just kind of put this out there first. There's a requirement around like a legal notification for cookies right now. And I think that that's even an international requirement as well. Is that right?
Yeah, it definitely is.
So with that in place, you know, obviously when I hit a website and I agree to share that cookies, is that company just tracking me when I get to my bank account too? Or what kind of dangers possibly could come from just allowing it to add cookies?
Yeah, so generally speaking, right, most things out there are not nefarious, right? Most things are pretty tame, right? Like when you re-hit our website, we want you to automatically be logged in. You know, we need to save a cookie into your browser in order to do that type of thing, right? Now, things that, you know, that you're visiting a website and that little notification pops up and 99% of users just like click buttons to make things go away. Right? Because they want to read that article, you know, they don't want to be bothered. And that's a really dangerous thing. And that's a topic for a whole nother day. But, you know, let's kind of stay focused a little bit on just the concept of cookies. I think the important thing to kind of look at, and this is a little bit more of like technical knowledge, is, you know, when you look at a single cookie, that website that you're currently on can write a cookie directly into your browser, right? And if you don't want that cookie to be shared anywhere else, then there's a couple of things that the cookie needs to be set with, right? And these are things that are not easy to check, especially for the average user. You know, you want to look at, is that cookie a secure token only? Is it an HTTP only token? You know, where can it be used? Where can it be retrieved? And there's a lot of those types of things that the average user just has absolutely zero concept on how to even look at. And quite frankly, like it's even beyond probably the technical skill of what we could explain how to do on a podcast, right? Like it would require a video tutorial. So there's, yes, some danger in just blindly accepting cookies from all over the place. But generally speaking, again, I go back to the most of the time, 99% of the cookies that, you know, you are accepting are probably set with HTTP only, are probably set with secure site. You know, and probably are not being used in a nefarious way, but you just don't know.
So, Daryl, assuming the cookie is not full of nefarious things like raisins, what would a browser cookie be used for?
So typically speaking, it might be something like if a shopping cart, right? If a site has a shopping cart, it can record whatever data you had in there. I think the big misconception comes around, people think that it's just storing data, but kind of like what Jake was hinting to, is it can actually run all kinds of different functions, usually essential to the website. And so you can actually end up sending a lot of different kinds of data. These are based around maybe authentication, whether or not a user's been authenticated, right? Certain encryptions that need to happen on the site for the local data as well. And so it can run a lot of different methods inside of there.
Yeah, something that's actually at Fortnite, right? Everyone knows about Fortnite. So Epic Games actually was using Cookie Store to save your auth tokens, right? And again, this is auth tokens. There's another potential, you know, word of the week. But an auth token is essentially a big long string that says, I am who I am, right?
This is where we start talking about like a JWT.
Yeah, a JWT, exactly, right? And so that's one of those things that if someone gets access to your JWT or your auth token, they are, for all intents and purposes, you. They can act as you. Every single website will think they're you. And the thing that's scary is, again, Fortnite recently had a vulnerability, actually, where auth tokens were stolen through an unsecure cookie, through an unsecure website that was being served over HTTP as opposed to HTTPS. And so, you know, that's that. I think Epic Games lost something like $108 million with this. And, you know, I don't have all the details here in front of me, but that was just here recently, I think within this last year.
So with a concern that somebody may have data of mine in a cookie, whether it's going to run a nefarious function or have just information that, while all intents and purposes, was originally supposed to be helpful, is now hurtful, what are some of the things I can do as a user to keep myself safe?
I think one of the biggest things that users should do is, you know, don't just blindly click OK on things, right? Pay attention to your browser. Look for the little lock in the top corner, right, next to the URL. If you're on a website that doesn't have the lock, don't accept cookies, right? If you're, you know, in the habit of it, or, you know, get into the habit of clearing your cookies, clearing your browser cache, clearing out that stuff on a pretty regular basis. You know, those are just some of the probably top level things that you can do to keep yourself safe. Keep antivirus software on, you know, things of that nature.
We are in the middle of a pandemic. I've made sure my antivirus is up to date.
I don't think that'll help you, but I think that's a different topic.
Okay.
No, absolutely. What Jake's saying is that's a perfect example of, if the data is just not even there, if every time you're using this and you're kind of going through and you're clearing that out and not allowing anything to hold on to that sensitive information, you're reducing your risk of having it potentially exposed or tracked, right? But yeah, it is very easy to go to a website that is not secure, or maybe a lesser known website. Maybe it's not as professionally developed as it could be, or they just don't have the team to perform all the security stuff that needs to be in place. And it can be incredibly easy to just have a simple little cross-site injection in there and say, hey, when you click on this thing, this is not actually going to go back to the server. This is going to go to me. I'm going to get your information instead. So just being aware of that and never storing any sensitive information in sites that you don't trust intentionally, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's other browsers out there in particular that are built with privacy in mind, you know, and you could potentially look at some of those. I think Tor is one. There's another one that I can't remember. It's got a little shield logo, but, you know, those different types of browsers are out there that are intended to keep you safe as a user. And, you know, it's not a bad idea to actually start using some of those things.
Yeah. If your browser that you're using, you know, is actually looking for those, it's very easy to spot them. It goes, hey, this request came in from here. It usually goes over here. It's not doing that now. So let's not do that. Let's not send that out.
I think the other thing to just, of course, throw out there as a general safety practice is, you know, don't ever check sensitive information. Don't go to your banking websites. Don't type in passwords when you're on guest networks, right? Like, don't go to McDonald's or Starbucks and check your personal information. It's a really bad idea. Like, save that type of stuff for home. General, like, you know, Googling, browsing for information, you know, that stuff's probably fine. But, you know, don't log into anything when you're not on a private network.
Well, speaking of cookies are always, for me, a reward. Yes, I reward myself like a dog. I do things good, I get a treat. Now, speaking of rewards, and this is my segue, I want to talk about GitHub's Game Off that's coming up. Starting November 1st, GitHub actually is doing an annual event where over the course of the month, they're going to kind of host a game jam. And it's essentially all month long. And they give a topic starting November 1st. And at the end of the month, you can kind of submit the game you built. Last year's theme was Leaps and Bounds for their theme. And they had over 200 games submitted for everything from side-scrollers to VR games to kind of anything and everything in between. So that's just a general piece of news. What advice would you give somebody, Daryl? This is I'm hitting this into your field directly. What advice? We've all done it, but what advice would you give to someone maybe just jumping into a game jam?
Go out there, reach out, and join a different, you know, join a team that already exists. So I've done a ton of game jams. Actually, I've been in that one a few times specifically. But that's kind of one of the things I always do is it's, I don't try to go it alone. I don't try to like wait till the last minute and join. I really get on to trying to find a team, getting in contact with them and kind of making a pre-planning out what you guys are going to do, right? And not saying like the game you're going to build or anything like that. But you want to get a solid team. Who's doing sound? Who's doing this? Who has, make sure we have all the knowledge to complete any kind of game we're going to build. Cause all too often early on, me and I'd look around. I'm like, all right, you guys are developers. Let's join. Okay, cool. And we get in there and, oh, no one knows how to do sound or art or anything else. Like we can't actually make a game. And so it just ends up terrible.
You mean diversity on a team is actually important?
Apparently. You know, I had to learn that the hard way about 6 or 7 times, but eventually I figured it out.
Yeah, I would also say, so this is a game jam that I haven't seen in the past, but it sounds pretty cool. Are there any restrictions on programming languages, game engines, anything of that nature that users should be aware of?
So no, and in fact, it's not really so much there's no like prize or reward or anything like that, or you know, they might have a featured game if one of them turns out really good, but if anything, it's GitHub encouraging you to learn something new. So they actually provide a list of several different, hey, here's some great libraries from, you know, Phaser to the Unreal Engine to, hey, you want to go build this in the Commodore 64 environment? Here you go. And some tutorials on how to set up and get involved in those type of environments and just learn. So it's really a drive to learn and have fun in a specified environment. And I know a lot of people, we've kind of talked about this before, sometimes have a side difficulty finding a side project. And so kind of this is that idea of saying, hey, let's help you figure out a specific theme around a side project. Like Daryl said, maybe we can get you involved with some other people and really just kind of hack something together. I have to laugh, though, when you say like diversity in your team and stuff, because obviously, you know, we've competed before, the three of us, and we all kind of have our different roles and what we do. And very much so. Like, any, I feel like anytime it's like, hey, we need some audio. Hey, Mark, can you just record this real quick? And I don't know how many characters I've been the voice of over different games that we've built. Daryl, you're the outside.
Yes, I handle all the environment or outside-related questions, absolutely.
I don't go to the outside, so I appreciate your expertise in what the outside should look like.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would also say the one-month timescale seems like a pretty reasonable thing. And just having been a part of game jam type ideas in the past, something that I'd throw out there is, you know, make sure that you set that scope, set responsibilities. Everyone's probably going to be pretty gung-ho like week one, and then week two it might be like, you know, and by the end of the month, you know, right at the very end of the month, everyone realizes, oh, we've got 3 days left. Let's try and throw something together when we haven't really dedicated the time that was needed. So, you know, set realistic goals, have some scope and idea of what you want to work on. And if the goal is education and learning, then, you know, that's what it's for, right? And so don't take it too serious, I guess, type of idea, right?
That's some really strong advice, actually. That's great. To kind of speak on that just a moment, there's been a lot of times where I've joined a team, and then I'm going, okay, we got 48 hours, so I'm just going to drink Red Bulls and stay up all night and all day and finish this thing. And then everybody else is just on there for like 2 hours, maybe a day, and not quite as invested. So definitely talk to your teammates and kind of set that expectation early so there's not that disappointment or the opposite of, right? Oh, game jam, it's a month long. I'll just put 30 minutes in here and there and have some really mad teammates and probably never get invited to a game jam again.
I think I would lose my certificate if I didn't say make sure to plan. As a scrum master, you know, of course I'm always going to come back to that. But I've always found in these kinds of things, right? We've always kind of had, okay, here's a couple of different ideas that we like that are fairly open and broad, right? If I look back at the previous years, so we had leaps and bounds. Then before that, we had hybrid was the theme. And then the year before that was throwback. So I think that, you know, if you come up with three or four different decent ideas kind of initially, you're running low on time. They are going to release it in starting November 1st. So grab that team, get together, and start to kind of come up with some loose plans. Then when that topic is released, really spend, you have 30 days. It's not going to hurt you to spend a day planning. And I know you're going to be gung-ho to just jump into the code, and I know that's how we always are too. And it's like, all right, no, hold on. I got to write up this lightsaber thing. And then it turns out completely unrelated, but it's cool, so I'm just going to throw it in the game at the end anyway.
I've never been guilty of that. Why stop looking
at me? That wasn't an oddly specific point out. But that said, it's something that, given that early planning time, you can actually end up with a much better app over the 30 days, including time of how much time you're going to work. The only other thing that I had is I wanted to throw into the news just a reminder that next week, November 4th through the 6th, is Vue Toronto. It is a free event. It's online, so you can go online to vuetoronto.com and register for a free ticket there. And yours truly will be one of the lightning talks.
Yeah, so that's pretty exciting for sure. And, you know, great conference. And again, shout out to the Vue team. You know, just excellent. And congratulations again for getting that talk done. So that's going to transition me kind of into the deep dive. And I feel like this topic that I want to discuss is like right up our alley, right? And this is kind of one of those things that I want you to think about over your years of experience teaching people how to code. What is it that makes a good student good, right? And so kind of to take that just a little bit further, not only is what makes a good student good with the, you know, programming concepts, with the learning and being able to actually, you know, perform the skill that it is that we are teaching, but what types of things do you specifically identify as this person is going to make it, right? And I think that's something that you can identify, you know, rather quickly as a teacher, is you kind of have those, you know, you can tell usually pretty quick, like this student seems dedicated. They seem like they're going to actually have what it takes to achieve the end goal, which, you know, for us is employment, right? And for many people, it's just acquiring the skill. But what are kind of those markers? What are those indicators? And what are some of those talents that or tips or tricks that students could specifically look at to try to develop to make them the good student?
You know, I think I'm going to start off with like pre-course, right? For us, one of the things we look at that is the hardest thing for us to teach that those people kind of have to naturally have is the love of problem solving. So these are the kind of people who are, you know, solving word puzzles or riddles or those 1-minute mystery books or anybody who likes to tackle some of those things and just kind of chew through them and really take time to think. If you find yourself as somebody who, you know, faces these problems and you hate riddles and you hate word problems and you hate kind of trying to work through some of this stuff, programming is probably not going to be a good fit for you. But if you are, that already shows that you have ambition when it comes to problem solving, and coding is nothing but.
Yeah, I'm going to kind of piggyback on that a little bit. Specifically to me, and this is kind of like what I go for in the debugging process, right, is it's all a series of questions. So they have to have that natural want to be incredibly inquisitive. If that comes to them naturally, they're going to solve their problems easier, and they're going to want to solve them, and they're going to want to know why and want to know how this works and, you know, what went wrong here? What did I do that made that happen? It's that natural questioning ability that really enables them to look at every single piece and figure out what it was that happened.
Yeah, so what I'm hearing mostly is it's the love of, you know, logical thinking, right? And I would agree, like, programming, there's so much logical thinking that really truly is required. It's not just like copy and paste, right? But what are kind of the tips and tricks that you guys do in the teaching side of things for early on, right? Especially when you have a student who's struggling with, you know, things like syntax, right? Like, how many times have you heard students come up and say, well, I know what I want to do, I just don't know how I have to write it.
So my first thing that I will oftentimes tell students is kind of think of how you would solve this as a human if I just like hit you in the head with a rock. That's a little brutal, but like slow your brain down and think through, because, you know, a lot of times we'll say, hey, you know, find the smallest number of dense array, right? And as a student looks at the array, they can immediately point to it and say, oh, okay, it's that one. And I have to say, okay, hold on now. Imagine you're really, really slow, right? You can look at that, and what's happening in your brain is you're immediately analyzing the whole array. And I'll try and take it out of that context and put it into a, how would I handle this in a non-computer way? So an array is essentially, every time I talk about arrays, I talk about a stack of cards. And if you're looping over that array, I'm going to show you one card at a time. And I say, what do you want from this card? And what are you going to do? You have a piece of paper, and you can write down variable names, and you can write down whatever you want off of this card. What do you want to be able to solve this problem? And then on the next time I put that down and draw another card, what's the comparison you want to make? So to me, the first step, if you're kind of struggling in that and you're trying to work towards those logical solutions, is really how do you solve it without code?
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. I always encourage my students, like, very first thing when we're getting into JavaScript, all right, I don't know how to write a function. I go, okay, write the word function, name it, put the parens on there. Congratulations, you just wrote a function. The stuff that goes inside of it, that is always going to be a thing that you have to think about. It's not that you don't know how to write a function or that you're necessarily struggling with that syntax. You're struggling with figuring out the job of this function. And so we kind of take a step back and we go, well, why is that? Why are we struggling with this? What is this intended to do? And most of the time, they don't have an immediate answer. And so I can say, hey, there's your problem right there. Like, you know the end result you want, but you have not yet identified every single step that you're going to have to take to get there. And so kind of writing that out in the pseudocode is what we call it. What are the steps I'm going to need to take? And then even going back to those and I go, okay, we still don't even have enough information. Look at this first step here. What's this required to even work? We need this piece of data. Do we have that right now? Where is this coming from? And so it's just, again, going back to that naturally inquisitive nature of what do all these things need to work together, and just looking at each smaller piece and breaking it down smaller if you need to.
Yeah, I think all so often I have the end goal in mind, right? I can see the two. I know where I want to end up, but there's a process for getting there, right? And it's a lot of times overlooking the small process piece that a lot of people really truthfully struggle with when it comes to programming, right? And so to kind of go into this next question, or another thing that students tend to really struggle with that I have personally seen, is the whole concept that is, okay, and we've talked about this 100 times on this podcast in particular, and it's abstraction, but it's how are things wired together? Like, I don't understand, you know, I have a function that's called, you know, get dogs, and I have the same function in six different places. Like, how do you start connecting those dots? And, you know, why do we have this type of concept, right? Like, how do you explain that to the new developer?
So the other thing I'd kind of like to do, and this is me, and I know any of our students who are listening from the last couple of years are going to laugh at this. I love Paint. Microsoft Paint. In my opinion,
I have never seen someone so talented in Paint, by the way. I would just agree. Throw that out there.
So for me, whether it's Paint or whether it's some other document or some even on physical paper, right, because I can't draw, but I can definitely use Paint, I like to actually map out those connections. Let me actually make a box that is my file and put the functions in it and draw essentially lines. And when I'm teaching, this is what I do. And most often this comes when we start to look at like the MVC pattern, where we have, okay, we have a bunch of controllers, and we have a bunch of services, and we have a store, and how does data flow? And a lot of times I'll do exactly that. I'll draw a box for each of those files, write the function in it, and then draw a line from one to the next. Now, early on, you're going to probably do this, okay? And eventually you won't need to anymore. But if you are that Always Sunny situation where you have the red yarn stringing all across your room, fine, great. We've had students print out their application. And in the early phases, it doesn't matter how you get there as long as you get there, right? You'll eventually need to do it without that. But you'll find that the more practice you get being able to relate, okay, when I say get dogs here, what is the reference? And more often than not, that I will tell students, if you are using a variable that you didn't declare in this file, you probably made a mistake somewhere. You either had to import it and you forgot, or it is declared in here. the thing that always I always catch those students on is they say, I say, okay, cool, here, you're using this variable here. Where's that coming from? And then they change files and I say, no, go back. Where is that value coming from? And then that's when they realize, oh, I can't access things from other files without bringing them into this one.
Yeah, passing things around, of course, right? So a question, I'll just kind of throw at you guys, and you know, I'm going off my own internal list here, and we haven't jumped it yet, so that's good.
I'll keep trying, now that I know there's a list.
How much of programming is memorization? And what are the types of things that should be memorized versus can't be memorized? And I throw that word can't be in there for a very particular reason.
Do you want to start with that one, Daryl?
Yeah, I can go with that one. So I personally, that's a hard one. Memorization, there's plenty of things that I do actually try to memorize. And it's, how do I want to explain this? I don't think memorization is the most important piece of it, okay? I happen to have a pretty decent memory when it comes to this, and it helps me with debugging faster, but it's not necessarily an essential skill that I have to have. There's always more things to learn and always more things to memorize, and it's really just impossible. Like you said, it's just not something you can do. It's not knowable. Most applications end up getting to a point where they're beyond the scope of knowability very, very quickly, very easily. So the most important thing to me, I think, is just kind of going back to that inquisitive nature and going, well, I have this particular block here, this box that needs to do this said action. Okay, what do I need to have that action actually become accomplished and reach my end result, right? And a lot of times I'll draw some more boxes up there. Okay, we need these three other things to come into this box, right? And right away, I don't need to know what any of those three things are definitively, right? I just know that they need to exist in order to accomplish this goal. And so I'll write kind of a whole bunch of different boxes on the, maybe draw it out on the whiteboard or whatever.
MS Paint.
MS Paint, right? And we'll get our inputs and our outputs and kind of what needs to happen inside of there. And we get that idea going. And so now we go back and we connect those references. We look at that first box and we go, okay, well, it's this piece of data. Do we have that already? Does that live anywhere? Yes or no, right? If it doesn't live anywhere, okay, there's another box. We're going to have to make this exist somewhere. And it's just really going back through and mapping this all the way out until you know all those pieces. You don't need to know them all together exactly or have them memorized. You just need to know where things are coming from and where they're going to go in the one little tiny box you're looking at that moment in time.
It sounds very much like Legos, right? Like you're
absolutely.
Little blocks to build bigger blocks, right?
I would say the other thing, though, that is worth memorization, and this is something that I do memorize, and it's essentially the prototype methods. I think, and memorize may be a strong word so much as know that they exist. Split, splice versus slice. That one took forever for me. And trying to make sure that you know, okay, I can do a map, I can do a reduce, I can do, those are all array methods in particular, object.values, object.keys, these different tools that are pre-built into the prototypes of the base types. Those to me are definitely worth that quote unquote memorization. And again, so much as knowing what is the syntax and what does this method do.
Yeah. So something to kind of touch on, and I think you're starting to kind of get there. What I was kind of thinking about when I asked myself this question was a person can only hold so many thoughts in their head at once.
I've downloaded more RAM, so I can get more.
I mean, most people are rocking somewhere between 2 to quite possibly 6 coherent thoughts at a time, right? And I think that's about the limit of where we are, right? And so when I talk about memorization, I think there's certain things that it's like, I need to memorize how you write a for loop. I need to memorize how you write a function, right? Like those are the things that you can memorize. You can memorize extensions and data types and things of that nature. Those are things that can and should be memorized.
Syntax, though, is the biggest kind of where you're getting at.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
The architecture of a for loop, the architecture of an import.
Yeah, because you can't, if you're spending your brain power thinking about how do I write a for loop, well, then obviously you don't have the capacity at that current moment to be thinking about how you solve an actual problem, right? And so I think as you're first starting to learn how to code, there is a certain amount that comes down to, you know, mastering a language, mastering a syntax, memorizing how certain things are structured, and then you can start to focus on actually problem solving.
I think one thing to kind of point out is if you're using an IDE, if there's a snippet for it, you should memorize it. Because more often than not, like try catch blocks and the for loop does it and a for each loop does it and a for in loop. All these loops are a big one, obviously. But imports and exports and all those types of things, the IDE handles. Be aware and don't let yourself fall into the habit. And speaking of like things I have to remind juniors all the time, because come that time when you go to an interview and whiteboard challenge, you can't tab complete a for loop. You have to know what those things are.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and I specifically put the word can't memorize, you know, or that phrase in there, because there are things that we do as developers that are not copy and pasteable, right? You can't memorize how to solve a problem that is a business problem, right? You can't memorize solutions like that. Like, those are things that have to be consciously thought of, and using the tools that we have at our disposal, we can write implementations for enforcing those things, but they're not memorizable.
I think that that comes back to something that frustrates me in the interview process, or people say, oh, you need to teach this more or things like that, is algorithms. And I feel like, A, that term is way overused.
Way overused, yeah.
But B, like the concept of algorithms, and from what I've experienced and what people are actually looking for, are not even close to something that's really like – that's not a teachable thing. Like, oh, you need to learn the algorithm for how to – you know, sort a dictionary or, you know, whatever. And to me, those aren't really, it's those pieces that build up to the whole function. And those are more learning and not memorizing. And like you said, it's, you know, I've learned the tools in my tool belt, but I need to know how to use them to build a house.
Yeah, I think, you know, algorithms, right? Like that word, I would agree, definitely overused. But, you know, memorizing how to write a sort algorithm, just use the built-in sort methods, right? Like, don't memorize that. Do not spend your brain power there. That's not worth your, as we like to say, tea, right? Time, energy, and effort.
Yeah, if I'm going to shove that thing in there, something else more important is probably going to fall out. And I don't want that.
Right. So to kind of wrap up this discussion, again, you know, is the concept of what makes a good student, right? And as a teacher, how do you actually teach programming? What would you say if I said you have, you know, 10 words or you have a sentence, what is your best piece of advice to leave students with who are trying to, A, break into the industry, you know, B, learn this new skill and, you know, become employable in it? Like, what is that secret sauce, or is there one?
First, I'm going to say how upsetting this is for me, because in D&D, when I send a message, I get 25 words, and I feel like 10 is just far too limiting.
I'll allow you 25 then.
Okay, please don't count as I actually do this. My biggest advice would be to stay curious and continue to push yourself to do more. And that ends the 25, but let me elaborate. The stay curious, of course, encapsulates the whole ask questions, right? Don't just settle for it works. I don't know why. Oh, well, move on. I copy and pasted that from Stack Overflow. It didn't work before. It does work now. I'm not going to think about it. Don't fall into that trap. So the second part of that, where I'm saying push yourself to do more, don't ever settle, right? So cool, it works, and then now you've figured out why it worked. Don't ever settle for the minimum. I can't tell you how many times it becomes frustrating that I see students with just so much potential, and we give an assignment, and they hit all the boxes, and then they stop and go play games or go read whatever. That is so just heartbreaking for me, because I know they can do so much more, and you're never going to be able to do more unless you actually take that time to do it. So that's my shortened, condensed, then with an explanation, words of advice.
Yeah, I would definitely, you know, tack into that. That's the, you know, do that extra step, like tackle those bonus challenges, and know those bonus challenges, they're not written down anywhere, right? Like, think, go beyond what the assignment was and think about what you can do that's different, right? Like, think. I would say is like my one word that I would throw in there if I only had one.
Oh,
word
look at Mr. One Word over here.
But no, I mean that's definitely tacking into yours, Daryl. Parting advice for a student.
Yeah, I'd have to say patience and persistence. Absolutely. Getting frustrated at something, I let myself do that occasionally. And every single time I spend like 3 more hours than I needed to, it ends up being something silly. And I'm like, oh man, it's because you got angry. Got angry at the code and it senses it and it doesn't let you actually complete your function. I'm pretty sure that happens. But yeah, patience and then persistence. Continuing to go back and look at it and look at that again. Okay, I may have looked at this line 1,000 times, but I know somewhere in here something is wrong. Let me look at this piece. Let me reference this piece. Just going back and having that persistence to keep trying and keep looking at it until you find it.
Yeah, I would also agree with that entirely. You know, we talk about T, time, energy, and effort. If programming is not T, then I don't know what is, right? Like, I can't even tell you the number of times, and Mark even just last night, right? Like, we're working on a presentation for his view talk, and something I've done 100,000 times before, trying to figure out how to do it again. I mean, how much time did we blow there?
Oh yeah, that was probably a solid hour on a simple CSS.
Mm-hmm.
And I say CSS, and I hate CSS, but it's never simple. Is the maybe that can I tack that onto the end of mine? It's never simple.
Yeah, it never is, and that's where I specifically just kind of wanted to call that out. Being a good developer, it's not about memorization, right? It's more about exposure and not giving up, right? Having that persistence to go on, not settling, you know, and continuing to drive forward. We've had students who are not the most talented person in the room leave us and be the first person hired. And that usually comes down to their grit, their determination, and not necessarily their skill set.
All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and close it off there. I want to thank everyone for joining us again on this episode of The Dev Team. And if you've enjoyed this, please make sure to like and subscribe us on whatever your favorite podcasting network is. And until we see you again, this is Mark,
Jake,
and Daryl.
Happy coding.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of The Dev Team. If you're interested in learning more about our team or possibly starting a career in software development, reach out to us at BoiseCodeWorks.com. Follow us on Facebook and like and subscribe to this podcast to continue to receive the latest updates. Until then, from The Dev Team, remember, if you want clean code, wash your hands.